Hi, I'm Steve Clements, and I have a question. If you took a look at the world today, which side is winning? Chaos or control? Is our world becoming more stable, more fair, more peaceful? Or are forces taking a wrecking ball to all that and leaving crises as the new normal? Let's get to the bottom line. If you're anxious about where the world is going, well, you're not alone. A deadly global pandemic blindsided humanity more than 2 years ago, and millions are dead in its wake. Violent weather is on the rise around the world, in addition to the level of the world's oceans, wreaking havoc and dislocating people around the planet. And as technological futurist Bill Joy once reported and feared on the cover of Wired magazine 20 years ago, the rapid speed of technological advances in genetics and in computing power and its derivatives like artificial intelligence are outrunning our ability to make sure they're used for good rather than bad. Add on to that the rise of autocracies and old-style Russian invasions. Well, it's not exactly la vie en rose. But our guest today sees a silver lining in the big crises of this moment and suggests that what the world may need to revitalize the social contract of empathy and common purpose between nations is exactly this, a massive wake-up call. Ian Bremmer has just come out with a forward-looking book, The Power of Crisis, How Three Threats and Our Response Will Change the World. He is the president and founder of Eurasia Group, a global research and consulting firm based in New York that focuses on the risks facing businesses and governments. Ian, it's great to be with you today, and congratulations on the new book, The Power of Crisis. I guess what I find fascinating about this is I've read nearly everything you've ever written, and this is the most optimistic book. You're usually my cynic, who's seeing things realistically and wide-eyed. For our audience, you know, Ian is the one who is really the champion of understanding in the world that there's no organizing force anymore. We have a G-zero world, the headlessness. And I think what you're saying is that, you know, someone's going to come out from outer space, that big existential crises are going to hit us, and somehow order is going to come back. Am I getting the right message?
Yes. I mean, let's put it this way. I'm someone who really believes that geopolitics, like economics, have cyclical boom and bust cycles, right? I mean, we're probably heading into a recession right now. We've had them every 7 years since World War II. We recognize them when they hit. We've got fiscal and monetary tools to respond. We generally try to avoid them, right? But there are also geopolitical cycles. And geopolitical cycles occur because when you have a huge crisis, then coming out of that, you create new institutions and architecture that reflects the state of the world, the balance of power that exists after the time. So World War II happens. We create the United Nations, the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, right? Precisely because there was this massive disruption. We need new architecture to reflect the way the world is going forward. Okay, so for the last, since you've known me for the last 20, 25 years, we've been heading into a geopolitical recession, what I call a G-zero world, where the balance of power is increasingly misaligned with the institutions. And that's true both inside the United States and globally. And I've been writing all of these books that have described that, the end of the free market, right? The state capitalist China rise, and that means it's a hybrid system. Every nation for itself, the United States as, you know, sort of the G1 is no longer the global policeman. What happens as a consequence? Even us versus them, it talks about the rise of populism and the disintegration of institutions inside a lot of democracies around the world, the growing illiberalism of democracies. So now you start to see all of these global crises emerge, whether it's the pandemic or it's the Russia invasion of Ukraine and a new Cold War, or whether it's global climate and the rise of disruptive technologies. And this book is the book that says, okay, we're now in the depth of geopolitical recession. We know we're in a G-zero. What are we going to do to take advantage of these global crises that will allow us to get back towards a geopolitical boom cycle? I mean, I don't describe it that way in the book because that's a little wonky.
Right.
But, I mean, given the question you just asked, yeah, that's kind of why this is a much more hopeful book. It's a much more optimistic book. And if you remember from my dedication, the dedication says, to a glass half full, that first half was tasty. And it's basically saying, we're the ones that drank the first half of the glass. And so if we want to get out of this, we're the ones that are going to have to do something.
Well, I guess my question to you is, you know, I know this is just coming out, but how is this playing with people? Do they think you're utopian, or is this a realist way of looking at how common responses actually happen?
Well, I mean, Reagan was a movie guy, right? And I mean, the fact is that if you wanted to portray this as a movie, it would be like the very schmaltzy Independence Day. Aliens come down and everyone rallies around, you know, and we're able to defeat the aliens. What it isn't is this movie that just came out a few weeks ago, Don't Look Up, where a comet is coming and we all basically ignore it until it's too late and the world comes to an end. And the reason why I think that the response to this book has been much more positive, even though so many people are running around with their hair on fire right now, is because we've actually seen in the last 2 months, like, Putin didn't read my book, and it's obvious, because he made the biggest geopolitical error of judgment of any leader since the Soviet Union has collapsed. He invaded Ukraine full on with a couple hundred thousand troops, precisely because he believed that the West was incapable of responding, of coming together, that NATO was indeed brain dead and obsolete, as Macron and Trump referred to it. And my God, was he wrong. Irrespective of what you think about the United States and Europe and China and the rest of the world, we can all agree that Putin really badly misjudged this, because not only is Zelensky still there running Ukraine, he has vastly more support than he did before. The Finns and the Swedes are about to join NATO. The Germans are spending twice as much on defense going forward. Heck, even the Democrats and Republicans can agree that they hate Putin more than they hate each other. We just had Pelosi go to Kiev, and then a week later, McConnell goes to Kiev with their delegations. So, I mean, I think if you want to look at these other global crises, you can indeed see that if the crisis is big enough, even a seriously dysfunctional and divided government can get its act together.
I've always wondered to myself, what kind of shock could happen to snap people back in? And you kind of look at climate change as being really one of the leaders in that. And my response is, I'm not so sure that we've had climate change build up. We've seen the increase in violent weather. We've seen concerns. We've seen fires and floods and rising ocean levels. But I'm not sure. I still think a lot of people are comfortable as a frog in the pot that's getting warmer and warmer. Do you believe really that climate change is going to be something that you get a consensus of response on early enough to prevent the warming levels and to get to the targets that have been laid out in some of the global climate deals?
Well, a funny thing, Steve, that frog in the boiling pot and it gets slightly hotter and eventually dies is a myth. What actually happens is the water gets hot and the frog gets really uncomfortable and it jumps out of the frickin' water. That's what actually happens, right? And that is what's actually and literally happening to the planet with climate change. 20, 30 years ago, when it was mostly about hugging trees and saving whales, you know, activists cared, but the rest of the world didn't do very much, especially because you're looking at the Maldives and Bangladesh and you say, well, if we lose those, that's bad, but how much does that affect me? I'm not going to those places. Yeah, but now that it affects California, now that it affects Louisiana, now that it affects your home in North Carolina, as we just saw on the coast, you know, sort of a couple of days ago, now that it's affecting Australia with the massive droughts and Italy and Germany with the massive floods, suddenly all the people in power are seeing we have to do something about this. And the big difference in the last 10, 20 years is the entire world also agrees on the problem, on the science. There's no more significant climate denialism. There's no more real disinformation. 195 countries get together every year, and they say with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, we've had 1.2 centigrade of climate change already. It's anthropogenic. It's man-made. It's not coming from nature. And here are the implications. Now, everyone doesn't agree on how to respond and who should pay for it, but agreement on the nature of the problem really matters. And even though the United States and China don't like each other and don't trust each other, the Americans see that the Chinese are investing massively in solar and in wind and in electric vehicles and batteries and the supply chains and rare earths around the world to support that. And so suddenly in the United States, it's not just the tree huggers. It's people saying, if we don't start focusing on a post-carbon future, the Chinese are going to dominate it. And the Americans don't like that one bit. So this competition, but it's a virtuous competition. And look, this is still much later than it needs to be. And there's a lot to play for. I mean, a 2.5 degree future and a 1.5 degree future in terms of warming is a difference of trillions and trillions of dollars. And it will affect hundreds and hundreds of millions of lives. So we can't get complacent. There's a reason why the Secretary General of the UN continues to talk about the urgency of having to do as much as humanly possible. But, I mean, looking at this from a broad lens, the fact is that humanity is responding to this crisis. It's a Goldilocks crisis. It's not a frog in a pot. It is not too big that we crawl into a ball and just wait for the comet to hit us, but not too small that we're complacent anymore. And I think that's a very, very big deal.
And you know energy very well, and you've suggested in the book, you know, some proactive things that can be done. A green Marshall Plan for the world is one of these interesting ideas that you put on the table that could begin to rationalize how we collectively respond to these crises. But while you put that on the table, we've seen the geopolitical crisis of Russia's invasion of Ukraine drive oil and energy and gas prices up. You see the price of coal skyrocketing. You've got nations scrambling around energy and how they'll be backstopped by allies. You've seen the Biden administration open up oil and gas leases again that have been shut down. Can these swim together? Can we simultaneously respond, you know, by opening up the fossil fuel world again during this crisis, but also meet the goals that you're talking about of making major moves on climate remediation?
Well, Steve, I mean, as you know, they do swim together because much higher energy prices give you a lot greater impetus to move faster towards renewables and to focus more on nuclear, which we see the Americans doing, the Germans doing, the Japanese doing. They were going to shut all this stuff down. Now they're saying, oh, we need this more. And, okay, some people think that nuclear is not renewable. It's not fossil fuels. It's not contributing to climate change. It really matters. You focus more on efficiency when energy prices are really high. If energy prices were really low for coal and oil and gas, then you'd be much more concerned about how long the transition is going to be and about the fact that, well, you know, maybe it's too damn expensive to go to solar. It's too expensive to move your car to electric. No, we're seeing that these things are becoming cheaper at scale and much more compelling. Now, the Green Marshall Plan is really important because in this environment, what we've seen is over a billion Indians in the last 2 months have been so heat stressed by 120 degree Fahrenheit weather in Delhi just yesterday that they can't work outside after 10 a.m. And so the Indian government is, and they're dealing with rolling blackouts, and the Indian government saying, look, that all of this is happening not because of us, we're poor. It's happening because of you guys that put all this carbon in the atmosphere. So unless you're going to pay us to make a transition, you know what? We're going to use a lot more coal. So it is absolutely true that for the poorest countries in the world, you know, American policymakers can't just focus on the United States and its production, but need to focus on making this more equitable for the Indians, more equitable for the Brazils, and not just yelling at them at cutting down their rainforests, but being willing to help ease that transition because they can't afford it the way the Americans can and the Europeans can. So that's really the call to arms in that chapter of my book.
You know, another element of chaos and fear that I enjoyed reading in your book was your concern about autonomous drones, about AI, about tech that's kind of untethered to our needs and direction. And I've been reading a lot about autonomous lethal weapon systems lately. It's a little like out of Terminator and Arnold Schwarzenegger coming back with Skynet. But these things are real, and we are really moving to a period where science fiction has become reality in many of the autonomous systems there. I'd like to know how you wrestle with that and tell our audience, if you wouldn't mind, how you think we might, in a collective way, begin to respond to some of these potential threats in technology.
Well, I'd like to be as optimistic as I am on climate. I'm not yet, for one obvious reason, which is that we, as humanity, do not yet agree on what the problem is. I mean, we have an intergovernmental panel on climate change that meets every year and says this is the state of the planet in terms of climate change. There is no intergovernmental panel on artificial intelligence, on the dangers of disinformation, on where we are in terms of lethal autonomous weapons, on where we are in terms of cyber offensive attacks and capabilities. You can't fix a problem that you don't agree on and identify to start. So you need to start there. And if my book does nothing else, I'm hoping that this will be a more strong nudge into that direction, something I've discussed at great length with the Secretary General at the UN. We have strong agreement around that, but we need it from the governments. And not just the governments, Steve. Unlike issues of responding to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, when you talk about lethal autonomous weapons and cyber weapons, it's not just the governments. The companies, the tech companies, actually exert sovereignty, dominion over this space. And they're going to need to be actors, principal actors in any institutional architecture you build. So if you wanted to create the ability to identify these problems and then respond to them, it wouldn't just be getting a bunch of governments. It'd be getting a bunch of governments, but also some core American and Chinese tech companies that are actually the most powerful actors in determining the diffusion of these technologies. I think that's where you have to start. And then from there, you can start talking about what are the areas that you need to actually try to have in a public sector way, containing proliferation in technologies, or managing the proliferation of technologies, or criminalizing the proliferation of those technologies, as we have effectively for 75 years with nuclear weapons. But it's a lot harder to do with these issues of cyber weapons that increasingly rogue states and even organizations have capacity to do massive damage to our economies and even our species.
Have you translated the book into Chinese and sent it to Xi Jinping and also sent one to the White House? Because you lay out pretty clearly the fact that you see the United States and China on a collision course. They don't need to stay on there, but things could get bad. And it's one of the precursors to getting some of these things right, is that the United States and China have to realize at some level they need each other.
I am less pessimistic about the U.S.-China relationship for two reasons. First is the extraordinary amount of economic interdependence that exists now, and that despite the political incentives to beat each other up, everyone in power understands the importance of that interdependence. We're not going to suddenly decouple ourselves from China. They're not going to suddenly decouple themselves from us. And furthermore, the crises that I write about this in this book, they may not create more trust between the U.S. and China, but they absolutely create more interdependence. And I think that's really important. And I also recognize that on the back of this crisis of Russia invading Ukraine, for all of the Chinese saying that they're friends without limits with Putin, 2 months later, we also recognize that they're friends largely without benefits, because the Chinese government understands that they need to do much more business with the Americans and the Europeans than they do with a Russian economy that is one-tenth their size. So there's pragmatism in the part of both of these governments that I think help ensure that we don't head into a Cold War, which would make it so much harder to respond to any of these crises.
What I also hear you saying, and I it's not said enough, is that decoupling, if you really go out there, because that's a word I hear all the time in Washington, is equivalent to a global depression, a massive collapse of quality of life in the United States, probably the same in China, elsewhere in the world. Is that what you're, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but when I hear decoupling, I say crazy. But am I getting that wrong?
Well, no, you're absolutely right. It's just that the words are different from the reality. Mm-hmm. I mean, people talk about decoupling, and what they really then mean is, well, in areas of dual use for key national security issues, we shouldn't be allowing the Chinese to buy advanced robotics companies. Well, that seems fairly sensible. Huawei, which is basically owned by the Chinese military, we may not want them to be providing chips in our smart grid or to have surveillance, you know, sort of into American data. Like, I get that. But that's very different from saying that we no longer want the Chinese and Americans to travel to each other's countries. We don't want Chinese tourism anymore.
Right.
We don't want them to buy our treasuries anymore. We don't want them to buy real estate or come to our universities. How many universities in America would go bankrupt if Chinese students stopped paying full freight? Believe me. I mean, when I look at the NBA, I look at Disney, I look at American banks, I look at American consumers going to Walmart and buying goods that are inexpensive. The amount of interdependence between our two economies is massive. And I hear words like friendshoring and friendsourcing, which says, oh, we want to make sure that all of our, you know, sort of supply chain is with countries that we like. those changes are at the margins. They're incremental. But you're not going to suddenly end globalization by saying those words, because most of the big corporations out there are global corporations. They want to be global corporations. They want access to global markets. And China is soon going to be the largest economy in the world. A large majority of most of the countries in the world trade more with China than the United States. They don't do that because they like China. They don't do that because they want to be authoritarian. They do it because the Chinese market is so important. So we all do kind of get that, even though we don't want to say it.
Let me ask you finally, and I want to commend you for taking the risk of trying to put ideas on the table, because it leaves it open, people criticizing, but some of them you suggested is, you know, a global COVID response sharing plan, a global COVAX, a Green Marshall Plan, which we discussed, a World Data Organization. These are interesting, concrete ideas. But one of the things I know, Ian, is you do see some leaders out there willing to take that risk of trying to lead and putting ideas on the table. Share with our audience some of the leaders in the world you admire, if you would.
Look, I mean, I think around the world, I like what I see from the new Japanese Prime Minister, Kishida, in terms of his willingness to try to integrate Japan more into a leadership role, multilaterally, supporting rule of law. It's the Japanese usually are, you know, sort of responsible leaders domestically, but they don't want to play a very international role. I think that's been interesting. Also, specifically in trying to improve the relationship with South Korea, which has been broken for a while, but they're both allies of the United States, and that's kind of dysfunctional. Mm. I've been impressed with that. I was enormously impressed with Olaf Scholz, who, you know, gave this huge speech. It was almost the equivalent of Nixon going to China. Hmm. The head of the Social Democratic Party saying, we cannot go ahead with Nord Stream 2. We have to spend more on defense. We must be leaders of NATO and the European Union together. I thought that was a pretty big deal. So I'd like to see that. I think there are a lot of leaders like that around the world, people who are leading with facts, leading with science. Some are on the left, some are on the right, but they're important. I think the Greek prime minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, leading a country that went through a depression of greater depth and breadth than the United States went through 100 years ago, and seeing the response to COVID and the enormous redistribution of wealth from wealthy countries to poorer countries inside Europe as a Marshall Plan for Greece, and wanting to take advantage of that. And Euroscepticism in Greece is so much lower today than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. I think that's a big deal. And finally, I would focus on Ursula von der Leyen and on all of the European leaders in Brussels who are creating the most important supranational institution of governance in the world today, not just in terms of regulating tech, but leaning into climate, responding to COVID. I mean, we need, in a world that is falling apart in terms of regulations and rules, where rule of law seems weaker, where, you know, sort of democracies are becoming hybrid and becoming illiberal, it's important to have people that stand up for rule of law, people that stand up for human rights, people that stand up for multilateralism. And the EU is doing a good job with that. And I think that helps the entire world.
Well, folks, this is Ian Bremmer at his most optimistic. Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group, editor-at-large of Time magazine, and author of The Power of Crisis, How Three Threats and Our Response Will Change the World. Thanks so much for joining us.
Steve, it's always a pleasure.
So what's the bottom line? The world needs new ideas. No one disagrees that chaos is unfolding and needs a real response. My guest today has three tangible solutions: a global COVAX response to the current and future pandemics, a global Green Marshall Plan, and a World Data Organization. Well, these aren't enough to turn around the cycle of bad news and fear of what lies ahead, but they are an attempt to build new foundations for humankind where we as individuals become proactive about dealing with crises rather than just allowing ourselves to be victims of them. And that's the bottom line.